Our speaker today is Senator William F. Nolan. Retiring Minority Leader of the United States Senate and Republican candidate for Governor of California. A 1929 graduate of the University of California, Senator Nolan was elected Assemblyman in 1933 and State Senator in 1935. In succession, the youngest member of the Assembly and then of the State Senate. He entered the United States Army as a private in June 1942 and rose to the rank of major, serving in England, France, Belgium, and Germany. While he was still overseas, he was appointed to the United States Senate and was then twice reelected and was unanimously chosen Republican leader of the Senate by his colleagues in 1953, 1955, and 1957. In 1955, President Eisenhower appointed him U.S. delegate to the United Nations 11th General Assembly. It's a matter of interest that this is the sixth time that Senator Nolan has addressed the Commonwealth Club. He will speak to us today on the subject, the case for the people. Senator Nolan.
Mr. President, distinguished guests, and fellow Californians, I'm very glad to have this opportunity to once again come back to the Commonwealth Club of California. While the Congress was in session, I felt that my post of duty was in the nation's capital at Washington. But once the Congress had adjourned, I have been traveling from the Oregon line to the Mexican border with from 12 to 17 meetings a day. I might say parenthetically, for those of you who have not been candidates, it's an interesting experience to read some of the things that are said and some of the comments that are made on the air. But I suppose that there is great merit in the statement of former President Truman, if you can't stand the heat, you should stay out of the kitchen. Now, just 11 days from today, one of the most critical elections in the history of California will be held. I want to give today what I call the case for the people in 1958. 13 years ago, after taking off my Army uniform to become a United States Senator, my first public appearance was before the Commonwealth Club of California. In the intervening years, I have appeared here a number of times. This will be my final appearance as a Senator of the United States. For 25 years, I have spent my life in public office serving the citizens of the state and the nation, and you who are here today. I believe that my work and dedication to duty entitles me to get some things off my chest. As leaders and representatives of industry, the professions and trades, you bear a heavy responsibility in this election year. Let me make it clear at this point that I am not talking here of support for my candidacy for governor. I am talking here of the responsibility of insisting on knowing the issues, where the candidates stand on those issues, and then supporting actively the candidates of your choice. When I stayed in the Senate performing what I considered was my contract with the people and executing the public's business during the primary election, I realized that this placed me at a considerable handicap with an opponent who felt no similar obligation. Now, there are several things that need clearing up. Perhaps I have been a bit naive. Knowing the facts and having stated the truth, I did not expect that certain responsible newspapers would continue to print falsehoods, which both the writer and the editor knew were such. Perhaps my regard for the press as a whole and my firm belief that with power must always go responsibility led me to expect too much. My opponent has charged me with seeking the governorship for 2 years in order to run for president in 1960. This is a lie. I have completed my full term in every office to which I have been elected, assemblyman, state senator, and United States senator. Knowing the great problems facing this state, I would not have become a candidate for the high office of governor unless I fully expected to serve out my full 4-year contract of office. I have stated, in addition, that in my judgment, the leading Republican candidate for the presidency in 1960 is Vice President Dick Nixon, and that he will have my support. So much for that charge. My opponent has charged that I was part of a deal to force the governor out of the gubernatorial primary. That, too, is a lie. As all of you know, the present governor, after first stating he would seek re-election, then announced he would run for the Senate. I have said before, and I say again, neither I nor anyone authorized to represent me had anything to do with the governor's change of decision. I have always believed primaries existed for the purpose of letting the people determine as between candidates for their choice of office. I have believed that the reason we gave up the old boss-ridden convention system was that the people would have a forum to select their candidates for nomination. Now, I have run in hard-fought primaries to first get the nomination for state assemblyman. I ran against an incumbent, and I had a primary contest when I was elected state senator. I was not afraid of a contest, and in fact was looking forward to discussing the issues in a primary campaign. Now, since I knew that I was going to raise the issue of a workers' bill of rights and of voluntary instead of compulsory unionism, and both of my then anticipated opponents were on the opposite side of this question, it should be obvious that if they had both remained in the race under our cross-filing system, they would have divided that part of the labor vote opposed to the right to work. Now, my opponent has said he was going to reveal the evidence of my part in this deal. Well, where is it? He made this statement 9 months ago, but there never has been, and there is not now, any such evidence. This proves again his hit-and-run tactics, but then it is difficult sometimes for the truth to catch up with such statements. Now, last week, my opponent said that if I were defeated for governor, I intended to organize a third party. This is an unmitigated falsehood. For 25 years of my life, half of my life, I have done my best to serve my country, my state, and the Republican Party. Now, if the people should select my opponent as governor, it is true that I would not expect to be a candidate for public office again. But I would not lose my interest in, nor would I abandon my party, as my opponent did in his, after his unsuccessful bid for the legislature as a Republican in the Roosevelt era of the 1930s. To the contrary, I would feel a deeper obligation to help redeem the state from from such a misfortune. I would be prepared to give wholehearted and loyal support to those candidates who had demonstrated such loyalty in their own public and party records. Loyalty is a two-way proposition. One should not ask for that which one does not give. I happen to feel, as the head of the ticket in California, a deep responsibility for all of those on the ticket. And I am giving my wholehearted support for not only our congressional candidates, number of whom are here today, Congressman Maillard, Congressman Allen, Congressman Younger, but all others on the ticket for the legislature, for the state ticket, and including Governor Knight for United States Senator. Now, I was hoping that in order to discuss the real issues involved in this election, my opponent would have been willing to debate with me in public meetings such as this, but he refused. The reason is that he did not want his record opened up for a frank appraisal. He did not want the affiliations of some of his close supporters revealed, and he did not want his program and the platform he stands on discussed in public forums such as this. I have been perfectly willing to discuss my record, my supporters, and my program, but he has not dared to attack my position because he knows it is sound, and so he just keeps on his runaway smears. But I do not intend to let this divert me. Now, what is my opponent's record? When he was campaigning to be district attorney in the city and county of San Francisco, he made a major issue at that time that his opponent, then opponent, did not try cases in the courts. His pledge was that if elected, he would try all major cases. He was elected. He tried the first case. He lost and never tried one again. Now, this practice bears out what has been his record in office ever since. He has been California's chief law enforcement officer for 7.5 years. In that position under the Constitution of California, he has more power as Attorney General than any other Attorney General in any of the 48 states of the American Union. Yet California has the largest increase in crime and narcotics of all the 48 states in the Union. Drug addiction is going down in other states, but it is rapidly increasing here. My opponent has ignored the recommendations of advisory committees he appoints with great public displays. One of his own agents had to be picked up, indicted, and convicted by federal authorities for passing dope to addicts. Now, what was my opponent's comment at that time? He termed the agent, and I quote, "a very good friend of mine. Why, only 60 days ago, I had in mind placing him in charge of the State Narcotics Bureau's San Diego office. That would have led to the directorship of the Bureau eventually, as State Bureau Chief Creighton is getting near the retirement age." End of the quotation. Now, on the same day, at the same place in Coronado, that my opponent, Attorney General Brown, is saying that there is no organized crime in this state, the Attorney General of the United States discloses that he is sending federal agents into California to investigate organized crime. When I revealed documented information from public records showing a close relationship between some of his chief supporters and elements of the criminal world, Brown says this is a smear campaign. He, the Attorney General, and Democratic nominee for the high office of Governor of California, has not requested to see the documentation which is available to him. Now, what about the platform which my opponent says is good? And what about his program which ignores the basic and critical problems of our people? The platform adopted by the Democratic State Convention is the most destructive, class-conscious, socialist-directed program ever offered to the people of this state. I do not believe that any responsible member of the Democratic Party, who is a traditional Democrat, can support it. I wonder how many of you here have read it thoroughly. This is what it does in part. One, it advocates the creation of 37 new state agencies, and with an expected deficit already amounting to over $200 million, this would either bankrupt the state, destroy our state credit, and impair our education and other programs, or it would require confiscatory taxes that would drive business out of California and ultimately end up with widespread unemployment. Second, it urges a repeal of loyalty oaths for all state employees and candidates for public office. Third, it calls for the repeal of the Taft-Hartley Act, which means, among other things, eliminating Section 14B, under which states can now enact voluntary unionism laws. Fourth, it makes it illegal for any government business to be had with any firm that has even been charged with an unfair labor practice. Five, it makes it illegal for any government business to be done, either state or city or county, with a firm against which a strike is being conducted. It makes no difference, of course, whether the strike is legitimate or not. Six, it would propose a repeal of the responsible relatives law, under which children capable of supporting their parents are obliged to do so. The architects of this provision forgot the fourth commandment, honor thy father and thy mother. Seventh, it establishes a state medical and hospital insurance program. Once again, socialized medicine rears its head. Eighth, proposes the increase of unemployment compensation and extends time during which benefits must be paid. Under this program, a man can be paid almost as much for not working as he can for working. Ninth, it calls for the strengthening of labor boss control over unions by all opposition to voluntary unionism. Now, this is only part of the program. How do you like it? Now, my opponent has embraced this platform and added some points of his own. He calls for a consumer's council, which would bring the state government into the activities of every business, large and small, and every employee. It would pave the way for a state price and wage controls under the pretense of protecting the consumer's interest. He and his platform call for a compulsory FEPC, which is, in my judgment, not in the interests of minority groups, but would instead aggravate the matter. He also calls for compulsory unionism, not democracy in unions. He calls for increased teachers' salaries, increased funds for schools, increased pension payments, but he never says a word on how the money is to be raised. Fiscal responsibility? That motto cannot be found anywhere in my opponent's philosophy. In the 8 years he has been chief law enforcement officer, appropriations for his office have increased 200%. His employees have increased by 100%, and yet our state has become a national disgrace in terms of crime and narcotics offenses. There has been little leadership from him. Does this record entitle him to promotion to the high office of Governor of California? Now, during the last 8 years, while he has been the chief law officer, the population of California has gone up 32%. Now, there are many statistics in which we as Californians are justly proud. We are now the second largest state in the Union with 14 million people. By the census of 1970, we will be the first state in the Union with over 22 million of people. We are today the leading agricultural state. We have a great highway system. We have a growing educational system. We have some of the finest flood control projects of any state in the Union. We have great reclamation and irrigation projects. But during this same period, there are some statistics in which we as Californians are not proud. Now, when I first used these figures, my opponent challenged them. And since I am not in the habit of using figures or facts without ample documentation, I revealed the source of my information. It came from a most reliable agency, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is headed by a most reliable man, Mr. J. Edgar Hoover. Now, what does that show in this period of time when our population has been going up 32%? Crime in California is up over 76%. Aggravated assault is up 112%. Burglary is up 89%. Manslaughter is up 90%. Rape is up 100%. Theft is up 63%. And robbery is up 58%. Now, during the five-year period from 1953 to 1957, the State Bureau of Narcotics has, during all that time, been under the supervision of the Attorney General of California. This is not a general responsibility he has under the laws of this state. This is a specific statutory responsibility which he has. During that five-year period from 1953 to 1957, narcotic addiction in California is up 237%. But what it was more shocking to me, and I think will be to you, to the parents and the grandparents of California, as well as to our young people, is that in the teenage group from 13 through 19 years of age, narcotic addiction in California is up 165%. And these increases are the largest of any state in the Union. Now, if my opponent cannot properly administer and supervise the one agency of importance under his department, then how can he be expected to administer the large and important executive branch of the government of California with our 24 great state departments, our 128 boards and commissions, and 46 independent agencies? Now, when one of my opponent's top aides, the then Chief Deputy Attorney General, was found by the Hearst papers to be engaged in a business deal with a man with a long criminal record, and he was found to have used his official stationery to expedite the business transaction, my opponent did not take any action. When the Chief Deputy resigned a year later to return to private business, my opponent Brown thanked him for his service and said he will be his personal campaign representative. My opponent has constantly said that I have been away from the state too long, and I do not have the close experience with our state's problems that he has. I might say that over the desk of a senator of the United States comes all of the great problems facing the state of California. There has not been a county of this state which, during the period of my 13 years in the Senate, has not had a multitude of problems up with me. There has hardly been a school district. I have had contacts with all the great state departments. I have had contacts with most of the municipalities of this state. I have tried both as a member of the legislature and for 13 years as a senator of the United States to help develop the water resources of California. Now, I, of course, challenged him to debate on our state problems, which he refused. I believe this is our answer to those fallacious claims. But maybe he has a point. In view of what has taken place in this state during his term of office, maybe I have been away too long, and maybe he has been here too long. Now, his rallying cry in this campaign in which we are engaged has been, "Have fence, will straddle." Now, there is an old biblical injunction, "By their fruits ye shall know them." I am willing to let my candidacy be compared with my opponent on this injunction. I have challenged my opponent to release the names of his campaign contributors and the amounts of the campaign war chest he has collected, not only from the labor bosses and those who have levied assessments on rank and file of the members, presumably for the purpose of defeating Proposition 18, but actually diverting some of those funds to the election of my opponent and the liquidation of myself from the public life of California. I have said that I am ready to do likewise, but he has refused. I wonder why. Now let me read from a letter, a photostat which I have here before me and which I show this assemblage. And this letter, incidentally, was sent to every liquor dealer in California. There are some 43,000 of them. It's on the letterhead of the Southern California Retail Liquor Dealers Association, 7456 Beverly Boulevard, Los Angeles 36, California. It is dated October the 1st. And it says, "Dear fellow retailer, since Pat is backed by both Democrats and Republicans, we feel that no matter what your political affiliation may be, you may in good conscience give your all-out support to him in his present race for governor. As you know, Pat Brown has had our solid support since 1950 when he first ran for Attorney General. All polls and even Republican newspaper editorials have stated that he will be victorious. We know when he is governor, we will have in him a warm, sympathetic friend of the legitimate businessman of California. We urge you at this time to send in a minimum contribution of $10. Please make out your check to the Pat Brown Campaign Committee. Put it in the enclosed envelope and send it today. Sincerely yours, H.L. Tarnoff, State Legislative Advocate Chairman, Pat Brown for Governor, Retail Dealers Committee, Irving Wasserman President, California Retail Liquor Dealers Institute, J.J. Charbloy President, Southern California Retail Liquor Dealers Association. Now, if all of them contribute the requested minimum contribution, this would amount to the sum of $430,000 from this one source alone. Yes, November 4th is an important date on the calendar of Californians. On that date, we do have a rendezvous with destiny. What we do may well determine the economic and political future of California for decades yet to come. Now, I think it is highly important that we also keep in mind the fact, and I say this on my responsibility as a senator of the United States, that there today exists a power in this state in the hands of two men to strangle the economic life of California. Those two men are James Hoffa of the Teamsters Union and Harry Bridges of the Longshoremen's Union. This is more power than any responsible men should want, and in my judgment, it is far too much power for any irresponsible ones to have. I would like to read you a quotation from Mr. Hoffa, as published in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on March 4, 1956. He said, quote, "The future of labor-management relations is big labor and big business, for there is no room for the small business or the small union. That is unfortunate, but true." Let me quote you from Mr. Harry Bridges, before he entered into his alliance with Mr. James Hoffa. This was on August 1, 1957, and he said, "If the Teamsters and the two dock unions got together, they'd represent more economic power than the combined American Federation of Labor Congress of Industrial Organizations. They are so concentrated. An economic squeeze and pressure can be exerted that puts any employer in a very tough spot, and furthermore, puts the United States government on a tough spot. If the AFL-CIO meets us head-on, we'd knock the stuffings out of them. We'd fight on their own grounds and win. Gentlemen, the hour is later than you think." I merely wish to conclude these remarks today by saying that as I have traveled the state, people have said, "Senator, why did you raise controversial issues? It would have been so easy to slide along." I want to say that this nation of ours would never have won its independence from the mightiest empire of that day if Americans had not been willing to raise a controversial issue. Slavery would never have been abolished in this nation if American men and women had not been prepared to raise a controversial issue. We would neither have gained nor retained our independence from the totalitarian forces, be they Nazism, fascism, or communism, if American men and women had not been prepared to raise controversial issues and, if need be, to dedicate their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to the preservation of our free way of life and our constitutional form of government. Now, my opponent and his labor boss allies have charged that I am a stubborn man. Well, perhaps I am a stubborn man, when it comes to maintaining the freedom of our country and the free world against the godless menace of international totalitarian communism? Perhaps I am a stubborn man. When it comes to maintaining the American system of free enterprise against those who would take us down the path of state socialism, Fabian or Marxian? And perhaps I am a stubborn man. When it comes to maintaining the civil rights and the individual liberties of American men and women to determine by their voluntary action and not by compulsion the organization to which they will belong. But I want to say to you that unless there are an awful lot of stubborn men and women, young and old, scattered from the Oregon line to the Mexican border and from the Pacific to the Atlantic oceans, we could lose this free way of life under which we've grown from a small, weak colony of 3 million on the Atlantic seaboard to a great nation of 170 millions of people, the most productive the world has ever known. And I can think of no words in which we might close this gathering today that would be better than those of George Washington when he said, "Let us raise a standard to which the wise and the honest can repair. The event is in the hands of God."